Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. 2020 has been quite the year, to put it mildly, and here at RCP, we've decided to take a break from the madness and ponder what it means to dream. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the action of dreaming is defined as a series of thoughts, images, or emotions occurring during sleep, or as an experience of waking life having the characteristics of a dream. In this extra special episode of Real College Podcast, Dreaming Edition, we invite our listeners to let their minds wander to the realm of fantasy and reverie, as we take you on a deep dive into the world of manifestation, a look into how sleep paralysis works, conversations about nightmares, one podcaster's journey to experience dreaming, and an extra special installation of Radio K Sports. Be sure to relax, pour yourself a nice hot beverage, and prepare to open up your mind. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. Everyone in college has a dream, whether it be becoming the doctor to cure cancer or opening up the world's first commercial interstellar paintball league. We all have them. And according to some, all that stands in the way of you and your wildest dreams is your ability to manifest. Here is producer Emma Morris with more.
When thinking about our dreams and aspirations, some might suggest making a 5-year plan or a vision board. Today, I'm going to be focusing on manifestation. I recently sat down with my guest to break down exactly what manifestation is and how we can start to involve it in our daily lives. First, can you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
My name is Madison Lang. I'm a recent graduate of University of Minnesota Duluth. I got my Bachelor of Arts in theater and dance, and I'm currently in a new undergraduate program at Boulder Psychic Institute, where I am on the path to being ordained as a psychic.
Next, could you give us a quick rundown of what exactly manifestation is?
Manifestation is a practice. I think a lot of people think of manifestation as like a meditation or a tool, but it's a practice to put out the vibration of what you want into the cosmos, and then allowing for as above, so below to run its course and have it fall down into the physical world and into your life. If you manifest only physically, you know, that completely ignores all of that internal space. And we receive things internally first, like via perspective and even just through adapting conditioning of like what we believe we can receive. So if we're not manifesting and doing internal energy work, the physical manifestation is only going to get you so far. So I really think ultimately manifestation is an internal process first and foremost. And the little physical external things are just like the little sprinkles on top of the cupcake, if you will.
Now that we know what manifestation is, we must acknowledge that many spiritual practices have roots in specific cultures and religions. Does manifestation have one?
This gets really tricky and ambiguous because it's really hard to discern where these big topics of as above, so below come from. Like, and I mean, this is not quite even just what I'm taught, but from what I understand of what I'm taught, the whole phrase of like as above, so below really perfectly kind of encapsulates how manifestation works. And that exists in just about every single religion, belief, culture, just this concept of things dripping down and absorbing up.
Now let's get to the good stuff, what everyone is dying to hear. How can we start manifesting, and what are some things to start manifesting for?
In order to manifest too, we have to believe that where we are at currently in all of our mistakes and in all of our conditioning and in maybe the show of where we are at, that we can still receive it. To begin manifesting, the first thing you really want to do is really analyze why you want what you want in the first place. Working internally really addresses the body's physical state, your physical state. And to do so, you have to be very honest with where you're at in the world. And a lot of people are really scared to do that. So the best way to begin to do that is just to sit with yourself. And when that becomes comfortable, you can then create an internal spot in your body, in your energetic space, that's like your little receiving bowl. There is a little equation that we were taught in school, and it's actually something I do every single day. I do it every single day. It happens in meditation. I suppose you could do it, you know, in like, you don't have to be like in deep trance, you know. Meditation is so much vaster than people kind of understand it to be. But say you're maybe walking down the street and you're in a very peaceful mindset. Say you're gotten in your favorite little comfy corner, and you got a little candle burning and you're ready to do some manifestation. Or maybe you're that girl and you got all the crystals out and you're like, I'm ready to go. Like, then we can start by putting some things in there that you want. The first thing you want to do is you want to visualize that beautiful and clean and true receiving space, however you want it to look. And then all you have to do next is imagine and try to visualize what you want. This could obviously be an object. This could be a physical thing. This could be an experience. This could be a vibration. This could be a feeling. I mean, really, it goes so much deeper than manifesting, you know, a car or money. Like, I manifest like how I want to feel every day. It genuinely could be anything. And you want to visualize that thing and you want to put it in your cute little bubble. And perhaps you have a few little images and you just want to observe and just watch those things float in that bubble. And then in all of the spaces around it, you can visualize how you feel when you have that thing. So you want to kind of put down visualizations or feelings. It doesn't have to be something you can see, just maybe like a feeling. And maybe it's this beautiful pink mist over here. How it feels to have it. It feels victorious. It feels celebratory. I feel at peace. I feel excited. I'm having fun. Yada, yada, yada. Just fill it up chock full with these beautiful things, these beautiful feelings, and just all of that excitement that it feels to have what you want. The third step, what I feel like everyone often misses, is grounding that space and removing then all of the negative or foreign energy that tells you that you can't have it.
Now, since we are putting things out into the universe, is there anything you would absolutely avoid manifesting?
Never manifest out of fear, out of scarcity. Really work and care for those emotions and feelings. Understand why they're there before you really do the work. And never manifest a person specifically. Let that person live their own life. If it was meant to be, they will meet you there where you are.
Now, to end on a fun note, is there anything interesting that you have manifested and have happen?
I have a few things. I manifested this interview to happen because I did a manifestation that I wanted to share what I know. And not only, you know, did you reach out to me, but I ended up creating a little group with my friends to slowly share what I know and teach them some of the practices that keep me, you know, keep me going and keep me feeling fresh and funky. I have also manifested this place to live with a very specific angel number, house number that I thought would be an indicator of the vibe of the house. I really wanted a house that would support mine and my roommates, not only like spiritual journey, but just like further acclimation into this world as adults and create like a very like divine sacred foundation to build upon. And I have this amazing, beautiful house that was more than I could ask for, with the angel number that was very specific to something I created. Maybe that seems like, you know, something small to some people, but to me, it was a really big deal.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
When we sleep, many strange things happen, including one particular phenomenon commonly known as sleep paralysis. Although I've never experienced the effects of sleep paralysis myself, the phenomenon has long intrigued me, so when it came time for the RCP Dreaming special episode, I knew just what I wanted to investigate. In order to build a foundation for my quest to understand this strange sleep spectacle, I talked to my friend and co-worker Julian Green. Julian, who is the program director here at Radio K, has experienced sleep paralysis before, and he was gracious enough to describe his experience to me.
I've had sleep paralysis and sleep apnea a couple times throughout my life. It's never been like a consistent thing at all. It's just like comes and goes. And sometimes like I'll have periods where like it happens kind of frequently. It's definitely the apnea more than the paralysis. So just like not being able to breathe in my sleep and just waking up and taking desperate gasps for air. It really sucks. It feels like you're dying. And like you just wake up, so you're like disoriented too. And sometimes that pairs with like paralysis as well. So like, you know, you just can't move. And it is a scary thought, especially like at first, but I usually am able to like calm myself down. The craziest time was probably, I think I was in sixth grade. I didn't even know what sleep paralysis was at the time. And I just realized that this was sleep paralysis pretty recently. But yeah, I would just woke up in the middle of the night, like I couldn't move. And I just looked ahead of me in front of my bed. And like, it was like this figure and it was like a rainbow and it looked like an old lady and it was like changing colors. And I wasn't scared at all. I was just like, what? I thought I was like dreaming, but like I was awake at the same time. So it was a very interesting feeling.
After Julian described what happened to him, I was curious to say the least. What happened in Julian's body and mind to make this almost psychedelic experience possible? Luckily for me, I was able to get some answers from Dr. Thomas Gustafson, a sleep medicine doctor here at the University of Minnesota.
So for sleep paralysis, we definitely have some pretty good ideas about what causes a lot of this, but we don't understand all of it right now. So the current theory for sleep paralysis is normally my sleep is really broken down into two types. We have non-REM, which is non-rapid eye movement sleep, and then we have REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement sleep. Usually REM sleep is roughly about 25% of our night, we'll say kind of as an adult average. And there's a lot of really weird things that happen in REM. So I call it being like a paralyzed reptile when I teach the med students. So in some ways, your heart rate becomes more irregular. You don't really control your body temp quite as much as you do during any other time of your day. And then we have this unusual feature where my body is literally paralyzed. And this is kind of where we're still learning more about what actually causes this muscle paralysis.
Dr. G went on to explain the science behind REM sleep and sleep paralysis.
If I'm recording brain waves during a sleep study, in REM sleep, my brain is just as active as when I'm awake. So unless we add in some other things, you may not be able to tell dream versus wakefulness. So if I'm in my dream and I'm wrestling ninjas or fighting a bear, whatever it is that I'm doing, if my muscles don't become paralyzed, they will do that in bed. So there's actually a related sleep problem called REM sleep behavior disorder where you don't lose muscle tone in REM sleep. And then people have actually injured themselves, injured their bed partners because they're choking out an assailant in their dream and their bed partner happens to be in that same space because I'm not perceiving my real environment. So it's normal for us to become paralyzed. Sleep paralysis seems to be when I wake up and that paralysis persists for a short period of time. It feels like forever when you have this. In reality, it's probably matters of, we'll say, seconds. It shouldn't be lasting multiple minutes when this happens.
Although sleep paralysis and sleep-related phenomenon are somewhat related, Dr. G detailed how these conditions may differ person to person.
Something that we have really tried to get away from is, I guess, sort of the psychoanalysis of dreams. So we don't try to put much into the content per se. So just because someone has a violent dream doesn't necessarily mean they are a violent, horrible person. We talked about that problem where if I don't become paralyzed in REM where I'll act out my dreams. Those are almost always highly violent. It's people like yelling, screaming, kicking, hitting. I've had a few people that one would do like knitting motions, one did conducted a symphony, and one would did the Macarena. It's kind of what their REM sleep behaviors were. This was a few years ago, so that was when the Macarena was very popular. So we try not to get much into kind of what is involved in the dreams. There are some very common dream motifs we think that make sense with what happens in REM. So a lot of times people feel like you have like a hard time talking, a hard time seeing. Often you feel like you're kind of wading through water or sand. We think that's our brains kind of perceiving that paralysis that happens in REM. Again, a lot of times our breathing is irregular, so people often will kind of feel short of breath in REM or in dreams. Kind of related to things like sleepwalking, which happens from non-dream sleep. People used to have a lot of theories that people were searching out something missing in their lives and they were, you know, spiritually unfulfilled or various things. We really try not to bring that into kind of dream interpretation.
When discussing how sleep paralysis affects those who experience it, Dr. G touched on what Julian described as a shadowy figure.
A lot of other weird things happen with REM sleep is we often will, for sleep paralysis, literally I will feel glued to the bed. You might be able to moan, move your eyes, but literally you cannot move your body, you can't lift your head. In some ways, we become a little hypervigilant during this. This is where if somebody will come up and touch you while you have sleep paralysis, often you'll kind of snap right out of it. Other parts of our brain are usually very active at this time. So they're called the vestibuli nuclei. It's kind of sort of our spatial perception part of the brain. Those areas seem to be very active, and that's why there's a lot of theories that most alien abduction experiences are probably a form of sleep paralysis, where often people feel like they're levitating off the bed, or you feel like you're being moved or moving. Often people will be seeing basically things from their dreams. They'll see like some shadowy figures in the room. They might see animals, people. You can hear like weird noises and zips and zaps. Very disconcerting. And often too, because since I'm paralyzed, I don't have my extra breathing muscles. People often feel sort of that their breathing is being restricted.
Dr. G went on to highlight how seeing shadowy figures or other aspects of sleep paralysis appear to remain constant from person to person.
Just because there are certain parts of the brain that are kind of more active during this time, so certain areas of the brain, and that probably explains why we tend to have these consistent experiential phenomenon during sleep paralysis. So there are different parts of the brain, including kind of visual, where that's probably why there often are sort of shadowy figures is sort of the classic one that people see. You know, we can't breathe. We kind of already talked about the vestibular, so you kind of feel like you're floating or being drugged around. And so the answer, yeah, physiology does seem to explain why this is consistent. And maybe I'm not going to ask you to believe in aliens, but may explain why there have been a lot of these consistent experiences that people reported. And why do abductions happen mostly at nighttime? So kind of goes into that one as well.
Sleep paralysis, unbeknownst to me, actually has a rich cultural history, as detailed by Dr. G.
Often there's a perception of something sitting on your chest. This used to be called Ridden by the Hag. You go back a long time ago. There's a lot of classical art with like demons and things, succubuses and everything else sitting on people's chests with this. Luckily, nothing bad really. It's really not felt to somebody's not going to die from sleep paralysis. You will come out of it. It feels like it lasts forever, and it's really, a lot of times, upsetting when you have this happen.
Before my conversation with Dr. G drew to a close, he had some words of wisdom to share with students.
I did my training at Hennepin County Medical Center, and they're, we call them parasomnias. That's things that happen during sleep, like sleepwalking and sleep paralysis. That was kind of the specialty there, so we saw a lot of those. I still find those very interesting, because during sleepwalking, you can do anything that you can do while you're awake, technically. So a lot of times, I think for people, if when they're listening, especially college age, a lot of us had maybe some sleepwalking when we were younger. It kind of peters out as we go through our teenage years, but often it comes rip-roaring back when you start college, because there's a few common triggers for sleepwalking that are associated with college, which is getting sleep deprived. It's been a little controversial, but basically alcohol has been related with sleepwalking. And that if people are sleepwalking, is let your doctor know, because it might seem kind of funny if someone finds you half naked out in the hallway, but the problem is if people get outside in the winter, we've actually had people die of exposure from sleepwalking. So if you get out of your room or your apartment, you should tell somebody, because then we usually should be doing something more with that.
After talking to Dr. G, I had to ask Julian what advice he has for fellow students affected by sleep paralysis.
Definitely talk to like a doctor or something if you're having like a consistent problem with it. And also just remember, and it's really hard to do this in the moment, but remember the best thing to do is just stay calm and try to focus on your breathing more than anything, because it can be a really panic-inducing thing. But just stay calm in the moment and consult a doctor after, for sure.
Bringing you the science behind sleep for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe. Although I only wish my fellow gophers the sweetest of dreams, sometimes nightmares come instead. Here to ask our fellow gophers about their worst nightmares is reporter Ethan Olson. Here's Ethan with more.
Nightmares can be very jarring experiences for everyone, especially because they're usually based on frightening topics specific to the one experiencing them. Because of this, we can never assume what nightmare another person is having. So with the help of Radio K, I took to campus to find out just how scary the nightmares going on around our school are. So what's your name?
I'm Ludo Wedge.
And what is the worst dream that you've ever had?
The most memorable one that sticks out is when I was a kid, I had a dream where this blue witch lady came to my house and started chasing my family around and threw like potions on us that was like burning us. It was like acid and killing us. It's probably the most memorable one.
So what's your name?
Sean Aldrich.
And what was the worst nightmare that you ever had?
It was probably about like 8 years ago after watching the movie Insidious. I don't think it was the scariest nightmare I ever had, but it lasted like 3 days. And I just remember being like waking up, not being able to go back to sleep. Just like I looked out my windows and it was like there were people still there, because it was like that was a scene from the movie. And just still, I can have that picture in my head of like the people just outside.
So what is your name?
Nadia.
And what is the worst nightmare that you've ever had?
I was walking home from my friend's house one night, and I stopped at my front door, and this creepy guy started biking past my house, and I made eye contact with him, and then he got off his bike and started walking towards me, and I tried to open my front door, but it was really heavy. And then I finally got it open and he grabbed my arm and I turned around and he was just standing there, and then my dream was over.
So what's your name?
My name's Raina.
And what is the worst nightmare that you've ever had?
The worst nightmare I've ever had probably had to be when I was 5. And I was at my dad's house. I remember this because every time I'd go to my dad's house, I'd have nightmares. So my mom and my dad are split up. But my dad, he would work as a landscaper for his like old buddies, you know, old college buddies. So one of his old college buddies had this like beautiful house, like in the middle of nowhere, you know, and like his biggest house ever. And like they had all these like four wheelers and stuff. So one time my dad took us out there when he was doing his job so we could meet him and play with his kids. So anyways, a few weeks later, when I was back at my dad's house, I had a dream that I was over at like my uncle's house, because that's what we called like all my dad's old friends were like our uncles. And my dad was doing his job and he forgot to like go to the meeting spot where like him and my mom would meet to like drop us off and pick us up. So my mom had to come and drive up, and I remember her driving up this like long hill, and then like my brother and sister and I were so excited to see her. And it was like a forest, because the house was so big in the middle of nowhere, and like we weren't allowed to go in the forest. And I remember my mom got out of the car, and then when she got out of the car, there was like a gorilla or like an ape or whatever, you know, and it came and got her. And I tried running after her, but like my dad like grabbed me and said like no, and then like I could hear her like dying, and I was like trying to get to help her, but like, and I woke up crying.
Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, this is Ethan Olson signing out.
When most people sleep, dreaming is something that they take for granted. But this is not the case for reporter Annabelle Ludwig. Here to take us on a journey to find the land of dreams is Annabelle with more.
My whole life, I've not remembered my dreams. Seriously, I tried everything sobriety, mugwort tea, journaling, and I'd only have a dream like maybe once every 2 years. I would ask everyone I met about their dreams, Uber drivers, neighbors, first dates, just to get a taste of one. So, this episode seemed like the perfect excuse to throw all of my resources into having a dream of my own. I consulted people who have devoted their whole lives and careers to the study of the subconscious. You can call it a masterclass in dreaming, if you will. For the next 20 minutes, you'll have instruction from the wisest minds I could find. And as proof that their advice works, I'll tell you about the dream that I had when we're finished. The first person I sought out for advice is Stuart Potter. He's a Jungian analyst based out of St. Paul. His whole psychotherapy practice is devoted to dreams. Here's what he said when I asked why.
Dreams help give us information about ourselves and about where we are going. They show us what we can anticipate and how we're adapting. They give us more information than we have access to during our daily life, during the day when our consciousness is restricted by what we have to pay special attention to. That is sort of the immediate purpose of work with dreams, but the deeper purpose is that it improves the relationship within the person between their conscious life and their unconscious life so that they're on friendlier terms. And if we work with dreams, the dream life seems to like that and seems to then want to bring the unconscious closer to consciousness. And the aim is to allow them to be on friendly terms or be friends with each other so that people don't experience as much resistance or conflict within themselves.
So there is personal benefit to working with dreams. There is some good to be had there.
Yes, even though people aren't always so convinced. Like I said, they sometimes have resistance to this new information about themselves and they don't completely trust it. And they don't completely trust the unconscious in the way that people don't completely trust what they don't know.
For our listeners, if they have the ability to recall a dream, if they have a dream that's been bothering them, that they've been thinking about, or even just one that they're feeling curious about, how might one go about deriving meaning from a dream? Is it important to pay attention more to feeling or to circumstance and story or to archetype when analyzing a dream?
It's important to pay attention to what the dream says. It's important to stay as close as possible to the dream. And while it might seem like it's just presenting the material of the dream, that material could be unique in itself and it could have special meaning. It could have a meaning that might give you a sense of whether you're on the right track, or a sense of what to expect, or if you're in the right place, or if you need to change things. We might consider some things like, where does the dream start and where does it end? And there could be a lot of information just in the first three or four words about the location or about who the people in the dream are. And then where it ends tells you sort of what the dream was getting at, where it's driving. And sometimes that could be nothing happened. You were anticipating some great event and all of a sudden you were just left there by yourself. That could be the meaning of the dream, that you, this thing that you feared, this thing that you felt you had to avoid, you were present when it happened and it didn't have a consequence. But something like that, that tells you sort of what to expect or what your mind is anticipating about what's going on. So that is an example of a rule of thumb, where it starts, where it ends. Another is, who are the people in the dream and what is their relationship to each other? I look at the male population and the female population. Is it all women? Is it all men? Is it two of each? And there's common symbols like the child and the child generally indicates new life. There's other symbols like related to animals, cats, dogs, things like that. Numbers are clues to what's going on in a person's mind that are elements of a dream. Colors can be representative of different feelings and different contents of the mind. So there's many things that you can work with, not necessarily to answer it or to exhaust the meaning of something, but to sort of expedite things, to move things along. The work with Jungian psychology, you know, is a work that can help people understand that they can work with things that might have more meaning than things appear. That if something seems to have meaning, it seems symbolic. They can consider what it is about that that interests them or that might have more meaning than what they've discovered. They can, instead of trying to explain something as it must be this because this happened, explain it causally, instead just try to explain it by association, try to explain it by amplification. It isn't necessarily a proof, it just seems right. There's two ways to know things, either by logical deduction or because you just know it because it seems more right than the alternative. So if we can work more with like knowing that things are more right than they're wrong, we'll be able to get more information, even if it seems irrational. So to be able to open your mind to things that you can't fully explain causally, to allow something that's non-rational and to allow something to have meaning just because it's symbolic, you can leave it at that.
So now you and I both have this basic psychological understanding of a dream, right? But after this interview, I still wasn't dreaming, and I felt like there was still a mysterious piece missing and not a scientific one. So I talked to Jamie Meyer. He is the president of the board of the Society of Shamanic Practitioners, but he laughs when you bring up fancy titles, so I will introduce him to you as the urban shaman of Minneapolis.
Pretty cross-culturally in, you know, shamanic societies, people view dreams as the primary way that we are taught by spirit. There's a somewhat widespread idea in shamanic cultures that the world that we call the real world is actually all illusion and it is the dream. And that when we dream, that's us returning to the world of reality. And, you know, I first came across that idea as connected with the Australian Aborigines. And I thought, oh, you know, they're pretty kooky, aren't they? But, you know, the more you read, the more you realize that's really a very consistent idea in shamanic cultures, that that the part of us that is lodged in the body is experiencing a dream or an illusion that has its own purpose. You know, there's a purpose for us being in the body and being incarnated and having our experiences in the body, but that at night, that part of us is kind of like, you know, laid low or whatever, and it sets free the other part of us, which is sometimes called the dreaming soul or the dreaming self or the double or the, you know, there's a lot of different names for it. And that part of us kind of returns home to the wider world of spirit where it can be healed, taught, instructed in ways. And then it returns, you know, at daybreak or when we wake up, it returns and it delivers that teaching or those messages to us. The vast majority of which, you know, we don't remember and we don't know because it's teaching on a different level than what our body-based minds is able to actually grasp or work with. To me, I can't imagine if you were to say, you know, that you, you know, Annabelle, you have been married for 30 years. But you know what? 12 of that years is junk years. It's meaningless. It's meaningless. You'd say, come on, man, right? A third of my marriage, a little over a third of my marriage life, you're saying is meaningless and junk, right? We sleep for a third of our life, you know, sometimes more, you know? And so the idea to me that somebody would say a third of your existence on this planet is meaningless rehashed junk from the psyche. If it's true, I guess it could be true. But, since we don't know, there's another angle on this, which is why would you spend your life saying a third of my life is junk? You know, why wouldn't you instead say, what a mystery. What can I do with this mystery, right? Analysis is the number one way to kill the dream, to kill what the dream can actually bring to you by analyzing it. It's a little bit like if I analyzed you, you know, if I'm like, oh, here's this young woman with this kind of hair, dressed in this color of clothes, and she speaks this language with this accent. Oh, I know what that all means. You know, I know the symbology of straight hair. I know the symbology of on my screen, a lavender, blouse or whatever. If I reduced you to symbols, you'd be like, really? You know, I'm a living being, dude. I'm a living being. And so analysis is the way to kill the dream, just like it would be the way to kill a relationship or essentially kill the humanity of a person. If I reduced people to symbols, it's not allowing them their humanity, right? So the first thing that the shamanic approach to working with a dream, where you're saying, I wonder what it's teaching me, to be open to anything and to allow yourself to, rather than analyze, to ask the dream like you would a human being, what are you trying to teach me? I don't understand anything. I don't understand the goat. I don't understand the licking. And I don't understand that language. What are you trying to teach me? And then rather than using the rational mind to answer the question, staying in the same dreaming mind just trying to listen, you may find that something is delivered to you. And it may be so non-rational or challenging that you're like, I don't want to hear that, or that can't possibly be true. But so the first step is asking the dream what it's trying to teach you and treating it as a living being, as opposed to a set of symbols. That's the difference between controlling a dream and working with a dream. That other angle on dreaming says, oh, you know, it's replaying stuff that happened to you during the day, but then it's putting it into a different symbolic context or something. So the white goat is actually my boss, and the licking is actually the boss saying, you know, you didn't get this thing in on time. And the language is, you know, my boss, because I don't like to listen to. To me, that wipes out all the wonder. You know, not to say that that can't be one level of the dream. You know, in shamanic thinking, everything exists on multiple levels all at once. And every level is true. It's true in its own universe or its own context. And the scientific worldview, coming from the rational mind, which says there's right and then everything else is false. You know, there's a truth and everything else is false. You know, it only wants to pick one level, you know. So it says, yeah, it's, you know, the goat is your boss and the licking is your boss talking to you. That's the interpretation of the dream. And that immediately wipes out the other many levels that you could plumb, you know, and get other meanings. And that opens up your life, and it opens up the beauty and the wonder of life by just saying there can be multiple medicines from this dream, and all of them are useful and all of them are true. To me, that seems like a way better way to live. We're a super impatient culture. And so, you know, the internet is full of 1,000 different webinars and books about, you know, how to remember your dreams and how to work with your dreams and stuff like that. I haven't read any of them. What happens for us is we're really impatient, and we want to know, like, right now, how I can have some technique or trick or whatever to remember my dreams and work with my dreams. And I think that at least in shamanic work, the answer so often is very unsatisfying, because the answer is it takes time some patience, some failure, and then some endurance, right? So the first thing that that I would do is acknowledge, like a lot of cultures that practice shamanism, there's a lot of variety in this, of course, but kind of in a basic idea is you have two selves or two souls or two spirits or guiding spirits or whatever. One is tied to the material body, and you might call that like the soul of the autonomic nervous system. You know, it's tied to the body, keeps your body alive, and it thinks the body is all that there is. The other is sometimes called the free soul, the dreaming soul, the double, whatever. And that's the one that can travel around in the spirit world at night or in other kinds of shamanic work. So I think the first thing that people could do would be to honor and acknowledge, I have two parts of me. You can call them souls if you want to, or spirits or selves or whatever. I have two parts. And by beginning to honor the dreaming soul or the dreaming self, by just making little prayers, you know, like before you go to bed, you can sit on the edge of the bed and you can say, you know, I want to honor the dreaming self as a real part of me. You know, there's much in our culture that has said dreams are meaningless. You know, like when you're a kid, and you go running into your parents' room because you've had a nightmare or even just a weird dream, go running in, you say, Mom, I had this dream, you know, this goat came and licked me on the chest and went blah, 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 blah. What's the first thing out of your parents' mouth? Oh, honey, that was just a dream. Go back to sleep, right? Minimizing the dream. That's not real. That's just a dream. That's a way for us to grow up saying to our dreaming self, I have nothing to do with you. You're not real. I hate you. And so why would it want to work with us, you know? So what we can do is start to reverse that, just like any other relationship that has kind of gone off the rails, but that's valuable to you. You start with asking for forgiveness and saying, I'd really like to rebuild this relationship. So you could sit on the edge of your bed at night and you could say to your dreaming self, you know, I'm sorry that I haven't taken you as seriously as I should. You know, I live in a funky culture, et cetera, but I'm ready to be done with that. I'd really like to build a relationship with you, and I honor you, and I ask for your forgiveness for all the times that you have given me dreams, and I've you know, thrown them away, saying that's meaningless, for whatever reason. I ask for your forgiveness, and I really want to change our relationship. So please work with me, right? And you can reduce that whole prayer down to dreaming body, please work with me. I really want you to work with me. So you could do that as you, you know, sit on the edge of the bed or as you lay down and as you're starting to fall asleep, you could just send a little prayer out. Dreaming body, I honor you. Have a good trip. And I look forward to what you bring me on your return. And please help me remember, you know, please help me engage with the dream so that I can learn, because I want to learn from you. Purpose of all shamanic work and really all spiritual work is to broaden your beauty of being alive. You know, it's about making life a beautiful thing rather than just this kind of like grinding utilitarian thing that you have to, you know, make your way through and compensate for with a little pleasure here and there, and then you die. You know, the purpose of the spiritual part of ourselves is to help us remember that we live in this incredible, nonsensical universe, you know, that's full of wonder. So working with dreams is just one part of working, you know, other parts of your spiritual life. It's just one of the things you can do. You know, doing this kind of work, you know, like I said, we're really an impatient culture. You know, our culture is really impatient and arrogant in a lot of ways. And, you know, we have so much trouble. And just about everything that our culture values as pathways to success run counter to at least doing shamanic work. I don't know if I think it also runs counter to many other spiritual paths, but shamanic work is so full of patience, so full of things that don't make sense. I was going to say confusion, but confusion is actually a rational thing. You know, doing actual spiritual work, there's no confusion. You know, like in the dream, all sorts of weird stuff can happen, but you're not really ever confused. It's just like, oh, all this stuff is happening. You don't get confused until you know, the next morning and you're trying to remember it. And then it's like, oh, it's so confusing, you know? But shamanic work, and I think all spiritual work, is so full of mystery and wonder, non-rational material. And we can easily, because of the way our culture works, we can easily convince ourselves that I'm not any good at it, it's not for me, it's a waste of time, etc. And I consider that to be a real tragedy, you know? People live however they want to live, you know? And like everything I've said, there's certainly people can say, you know, what a bozo. And they can live how they want to. I think it's just a tragedy to say, I'm no good at this, it'll never work. Because all it takes is patience, some endurance, more patience, some self-forgiveness, and then always just asking the powers of wonder, which I call spirit, to help you, you know, to work with me. I'm just a little human, and I have this heavy duty anvil of a rational mind that weighs me to this side all the time. And so I have limited skills. I need spirit's help. Spirit, I need your help. Dreaming body, I need your help. To do this work. So please help me, because I'm serious. I want to live a life of wonder and beauty. So please help me. And, you know, I think if you do those things, I think it'll help.
Morning. I just had a dream. It was like a really long dream. There was a lot of yelling, cussing, because at first I was with my family and they didn't approve of something that I was doing. And then in the second part of the dream, I was presenting the photography exhibition and nobody liked my art. Everybody hated it so much that I tore it all down. And I started from the beginning with some Polaroids I had in my camera case. And journals that I wrote when I was 5 or 6. I don't know what it means, but I'm glad I can remember.
So, I did it. You heard me. Something that I thought was impossible for my whole time being alive got made possible over the course of this podcast. Honestly, I think that anything we do in our silly little lives is somehow related to making the unconscious conscious. Don't you? Also, if you know what my dream means, you should tell me. This is Annabelle Ludwig for Radio K.
Before this extra special episode of RCP draws to a close, we will hear from Trask Angel and Grant Sandberg in an extra special installment of Radio K Sports Hour. Take it away, guys.
Hello, everybody. This is Trask Angel alongside Grant Sandberg, and we are excited to talk to you about sports and dreams and how those two come together. We talk with Reed Johnson in just a few moments here about his path through college, finding the sports world and starting to pursue it as a profession. As you know, Grant and I both are pursuing professions outside of the sports realm, but continue to follow sports as our passion through Radio K Sports. We want to thank you for listening. And Grant, take it away with the interview.
All right, so we welcome on Reed Johnson. Reed works with us with Radio K Sports, and he's even done some broadcasts for us. So Reed, thank you for taking time out of your day to do this interview.
Hey, thanks for having me, Grant.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously the RCP theme this week is about dreams, and you coming into college weren't in sports management or weren't in the sports arena really. And now you've kind of shifted that and come back for your master's, and really you're hoping to kind of work for, you know, it's your dream to work in sports. Kind of walk us through how you kind of came to that realization from, you know, growing up as a kid liking sports to now really wanted to work in the industry.
Yeah, no, it's been a journey for sure. Growing up, I, of course, played a few sports, baseball, tennis, dabbled in a couple others, but never saw myself working in the sports world. In fact, I had a good friend who goes with me to the U, and he came in as a sports management major and steered away from that, whereas I came in as a last-second commit to the landscape architecture program. And throughout my 3 years of undergrad, I just gradually realized that I didn't hate landscape, but my interests were changing. I mean, I had a vision board at my landscape architecture desk, and everything on the vision board was Minnesota Vikings. So that told a story. And right before graduation, I realized it was time for a change.
That's great. And, you know, when you make that change, that must be a big, tough decision, but also, you know, that's obviously one of your dreams is to work for the Vikings. And how is that something, you know, that motivates you every day?
Yeah, that was a big change. It was definitely scary for sure. Now it's a lot of fun, and I'm really glad that I made the change. Over the years of undergrad, it was pretty clear through not only things like the vision board, but working with you guys at Radio K. I actually give a lot of credit to my first basketball broadcast for being the tipping point that I was destined for a career in sports. But yeah, to make the change has been super exciting. And it's awesome to be in classes now that I didn't hate my landscape classes, but now like I just feel so much more fulfilled and really excited to see where the road goes from here. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. I think it's cool how, you know, you're able to go through and realize that change and go keep chasing your dream, which I think is great. Just, you know, a final question here, kind of when you look at the, you know, you realize now and pretty much everyone in your classes, you know, wants to work in the sports industry, and it's a tough industry to get into. How does that mindset of, you know, like obviously your dreams to work for the Vikings, but it is very difficult to get in. How is that, you know, it's difficult to achieve a dream like that.
Yeah, no, I recognize that the road ahead could be a challenging one. I knew when I committed to the sports program that, yeah, it's a super competitive field. And, you know, there's a lot of people in my master's program who they've already had the internship with an MLB team, an MLS team, you know, that top tier. And I sometimes feel a little bit behind the eight ball or like I'm behind schedule, but I guess I just have to remind myself that, you know, I used to be on a different path and I'm a driven person, and I'll put in 10 applications, but if I get the one, yes, then it's worth it. And I trust that with, you know, putting in that effort and not letting the setbacks turn me away, that eventually I will work my way into, quote, the dream job. I want to be a workaholic, not a workaholic.
Awesome. Reed, thank you so much for joining us here on this special edition on RCP talking about dreams. And I wish you the best of luck with the rest of your schooling, and hopefully you can chase down those dreams.
Thank you very much, sir.
That's all for the RCP Dreaming special episode. Make sure to keep dreaming. As always, stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.